Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Vincent van Gogh see the world, and what did it take for him to translate that unique vision into paintings that are familiar throughout the world more than 120 years after his death? Many of us know the shorthand details of the artist's life. Born in the Netherlands, painted in France and Belgium, but failed to achieve much commercial success, cut off his ear during a psychotic break, and committed suicide in 1890 when he was just 37 years old. My guest today has created a biography that goes far beyond those sketches, exploring not only the events but also the relationships that shaped Van Gogh's life and challenging some long-held beliefs about the circumstances of his death. Stephen Nafe and Gregory White Smith are co-authors of numerous books, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Jackson Pollock, An American Saga. Their new work is called Van Gogh, The Life, and they're in town to talk about it tonight at the Dallas Museum of Arts, Arts and Letters Live. Steve Nafe is here with us this afternoon. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The really striking thing for me in the portrayal of Van Gogh in this book is that this was a guy who seems to have had everything stacked against him. Even in terms of early on, he wasn't a particularly great pen and ink draftsman, thank you. And he wasn't very good with oil paint.
No, there's so many things that are moving about this life. I mean, Greg and I are so grateful that nobody else took on this book before us, because it really is the ideal art subject. And there are a number of things that are really stunning. One is that he just managed to pick himself up every day and move on. Mm-hmm. I mean, the level of loneliness and misery are just stunning. There were times, months at a time, when the only human contact he had was the waitress he ordered his dinner from. Hmm. His loneliness was almost physically painful, and that's aside from all the medical problems and the mental illness. But you're quite right. The other thing that's astonishing is this 10-year career. That's all he had, was 10 years. Hmm. During which almost all the great masterpieces that all of us know, the Starry Nights and the Sunflowers, were painted during the last 2 years of this career. And he had no obvious facility or promise when he began. In fact, if you look at the early drawings, they're basically stick figures. Mm-hmm. In fact, everybody in the art schools that he briefly attended, he couldn't stick to anything formal for more than a few months, was more talented than he was. He couldn't draw a face that looked like a face or a figure that looked like a figure, and yet he managed somehow to overcome that too and become perhaps the most beloved artist of all time.
He was sort of born under an unlucky star. Even the circumstances of his birth, he was born and given the name of a child who had died before him.
Yes, there was a year to the day before our Vincent van Gogh was born, the family had a stillborn who had been named Vincent. In fact, in Holland, everything is very conventional. Mm-hmm. and is done by rules, and the first son, especially in the 19th century, was almost always given the paternal grandfather's first name. So when the second child was born, he too was given the paternal grandfather's last name, which was Vincent. And whether that had anything to do with his mother's dislike of him or not, we don't think it had as much of an effect. There is something called a syndrome around replacement children. Mm-hmm. Where the second child sometimes it's hard for the mother to bond with, because she's so still so grieving so much for the loss of the first child. We don't think in the Van Gogh family case it was a determinative factor, but he does seem to have had his mental illness, we think, from birth, and it made him a very unruly, obstreperous, difficult, stubborn child. And his mother and his father just didn't like him very much. Hmm. It's hard to sort of accept the idea that parents wouldn't like one of their children. But when you consider that he wasn't just difficult, he was suffering from this mental illness, but they didn't really know that. All they knew is that they wanted to lead this very conventional, proper life, and this kid kept on breaking the rules every day, and they were angry right from the beginning.
Let's talk a little bit about Dutch culture in the middle of the 19th century, because I think we think of Holland today, and we think of people who are very easygoing, and right. They sort of embrace the pleasures of life. This was not the way society was when Van Gogh was a child.
No. In fact, I hadn't really thought about the fact that it's that many people who've been to Holland or know much about it know that it has rather loose rules on things like use of marijuana and other
prostitution
and everything. It was completely different 150 years ago, and that's because it had come through. Generation after generation of warfare. Mm-hmm. In particular, there were all the Catholic Protestant wars that had killed just tens of thousands of people. Also, the floods. I mean, by reclaiming so much land, they had laid themselves open to these terrible floods that would kill whole villages overnight. And the response to this precariousness that the Dutch people lived with was to look for order where there was none, and to create a set of rigid rules by which you lived your life. And it did help them construct a satisfying life, but if you didn't fit the mold, it was very tough, and no one fit the mold less well than Vincent van Gogh.
And his father was a Dutch Reformed minister, and his mother, I mean, is it too much to say she was a religious fanatic in certain aspects of
her life? I don't think she was a religious fanatic at all. I think she was she was a fanatic for orderliness. Mm-hmm. For her, in fact, there's Greg. In the division of our labor is that I do the research and he does the writing. Mm-hmm. And for her, the religion reassured the fearful rather than rallying the faithful. Mm-hmm. And because she just lived her whole life afraid. Whenever the father left town to go on some sort of on a business trip for the church, she was terrified for no reason whatsoever that he would die while he was away. I mean, that was the kind of woman she was. She was frenzied in her activity, basically to try to keep herself from getting worried about things. There's a wonderful quote from the father where he talks about Ma's busy cleaning like mad, thinking that it will stop her from worrying, but of course it never works. And she was concerned with the things that we don't necessarily today think are appropriate. She was terribly class conscious, meaning she thought it was really, really inappropriate to consort with people from a different social class. She was the first is more spurned than the second, but she dressing appropriately was really important to her. She considered the way you presented yourself to the world on the outside reflected your inner core of value. And so all of a sudden she gets this son who would rather go out on the heath and see the peasants than to go and visit all the richest Protestants in town, which is what she wanted for him, and who couldn't care less. He was always dirty. He was always running down to the creek bank and getting mud all over himself, and he just wasn't the son she wanted. And she never really amended that opinion of him. She outlived him by 17 years. Mm-hmm. And when she died, when he was already pretty famous around the world, she still considered his work, to use her word, ridiculous. Hmm. So Vincent never, ever got over it. He spent his entire life, short though it was, dying at age 37, desperately wanting his mother and his father's approval and never getting it.
It didn't probably help things that he had a habit of falling in love with women who were entirely inappropriate.
Yes. He was a very difficult guy. Mm-hmm. We think he had something called temporal lobe epilepsy. It's a kind of epilepsy that's not, you don't froth at the mouth and you don't...
You don't seize.
And you don't have the kind of seizures that grand mal epilepsy patients do. But you do have electrical seizures in your brain that create these terrifying blackouts where you don't even when you're after a seizure of that kind is over, you don't even remember what you were doing or what was happening during the seizure. It's a terrifying disease, and it also has around it a group of personality traits that are the most important of which are one, argumentativeness. His brother Theo said that Vincent would argue you into exhaustion and submission, and then the minute you finally submitted, he would take your point of view and argue the other side. And the another trait was what psychiatrists call viscosity, but what we might call smothering. Mm-hmm. If somebody came into his life, he would want to sort of embrace them and make them do everything together and be together all the time. Well, the combination of smothering and argumentativeness made him virtually impossible to spend time around. That meant his romantic life was not a very happy one, and that left him basically the only kind of liaison that he could create was basically with prostitutes. And the main relationship was with a woman named Sien Hornick in The Hague. He was with her for more than a year. And to give you an idea of just how sad his life was, he actually paid her by the day, even though she considered her and her children, not his children, but her children, like a family. And there are these touching scenes in which he went to the hospital when one child was born, and creating a place for the young child to sleep and helping to feed him. And he wanted a family so desperately. He tried to think of this family as his, but he was paying them every day. And from the family's perspective, if he had married not just a prostitute but a common streetwalker, it would have been not just humiliating for the family, but it would have created a problem so great that his three sisters, for example, would never have been able to marry. Nobody would have married the sister of somebody who was married to a prostitute, and he kept on threatening the family with that for years. So it's a little easier to forgive the mother and father for their attitude when you understand just what they were up against.
At what point in his childhood did obvious symptoms of mental illness start to manifest themselves?
Well, the first seizure that we can detect for sure in the letters happened when he was in his 20s in Drenthe. So we don't know for sure that the mental illness began earlier, but the behavior was so erratic that everybody commented on it. Because he was very famous soon within years of his death, people went out and interviewed people who had known him, and they interviewed, for instance, the family maids and the people in the village where he grew up, and they all remembered that Theo, his famous younger brother, was the nice one, the normal one, the happy one, and that Vincent was the eccentric one, the strange one. He was called a strange boy by all of them. So we think that since temporal lobe epilepsy can be congenital, it can happen from birth, we think there's a very good chance that the mental illness started right from the very beginning of his life.
It seems like if you put a second subtitle on this book, or one of those gothic "or" right. subtitles, you could have said "or poor Theo."
Or poor Theo. Yes, I mean the other because he couldn't maintain a relationship with either a friend or a woman, the only long-term relationship in his life was with his younger brother Theo, and it's a profound and touching and very complicated relationship. You know, many people know that Theo supported him. He was giving, during much of his adult life, a third of all of his income to Vincent, and on top of that was supplying him with his materials. So it's quite literally true that without Theo, Vincent wouldn't have been able to paint. And we owe Theo those, but it was also, you know, sibling relationships are complicated for most of us, and when you're having to support your younger brother and you're taking his place in the family as the sort of primary child, it creates a very complicated relationship.
My guest this hour is Stephen Nafee. He, along with Gregory White-Smith, is the author of the new book, Van Gogh, The Life. They're in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Nafee. Along with Gregory White-Smith, he is author of the new book, Van Gogh, The Life. They're in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Steve, Vincent van Gogh is erratic. He's troubled by mental illness. He doesn't have great relationships with his family, but he has to get a job. And so there's an uncle who is an art dealer and extends this offer to him.
Yes. In fact, his uncle, also named Vincent van Gogh, was the leading art dealer in the Netherlands. He wasn't just one of many. He was absolutely the king of the art world in the Netherlands. And he was interestingly married to Vincent's mother's youngest sister. Hmm. So Vincent was his nephew twice over. And at some point, Uncle Cent, as they called him, they used to do lots of nicknames in Holland, Uncle Cent merged his art gallery with Goupil, which was the number one gallery in Europe. It was centered in France, but they had offices in multiple cities. And because Uncle Cent and Aunt Cornelia couldn't have a child, his Uncle Cent's nephew, Vincent, our Vincent the painter, was naturally, it was assumed that he would take over the business. And so he had this unbelievable opportunity, and far from rising up in the business, he kept on getting demoted and finally was fired from the business, and not only fired, but was banned from ever stepping foot in the business again. And then the offer is extended to the 15-year-old Theo, and he grabs it, and he's well-spoken, he's polite, he's charming, he's everything that his older brother wasn't, and he does brilliantly in the business. He rises up the ladder to the point where he was the head of one of the three galleries in Paris, and was one of the first dealers to show the work of the Impressionists. Poor Vincent, our painter, our Vincent the painter, the only person that he was really close to throughout his entire life, and they were very close as children, on the one hand, he loved him profoundly. On the other hand, he had to resent both his dependence on his younger brother for all of his support, and he could never be completely honest because he was constantly having to ask for things from him. And impossible for him not to feel a certain amount of resentment that Theo had the place in the family business that was really rightfully his, that he had the love and support of his family, which Vincent didn't have, and that he was successful. People liked him. So there was this, it was one of the most complex and interesting and sibling relationships imaginable, and it is really the sort of central relationship in the book and in Vincent's life.
What role did Theo have in the sorts of things that Vincent van Gogh was painting?
Well, Theo being a dealer, one reason he was so good at dealing is he followed his uncle's line of thinking, and that is you sell people what they want to buy.
Yeah.
And so you figure out that people like things in pleasant colors, and they like pleasant subjects, and he was constantly advising Vincent once. In fact, Theo was the one who had urged him to become an artist in the first place, and then he would, with some frequency, encourage him to paint with brighter colors. He said that these interesting new artists in Paris called the Impressionists, and you might want to sort of paint a little more like them. And because Vincent, when he began, we think of him as the great colorist in art history. When he began, all he wanted to do was black and white. He wanted to become an illustrator. And the subjects he liked were really tough, hard peasant subjects. He liked peasants sitting around a table eating dinner, as in the Potato Eaters. And Theo was constantly saying, my typical buyers, the people who come to my gallery, don't want pictures of peasants on their walls. They want pleasant subjects. They want a still life. They want flowers. They want a landscape. And Vincent was so contrary that Theo ultimately learned that to tell Vincent to do one thing was to have Vincent do exactly the opposite.
Yeah, a few years ago, I had a chance finally to get to the Van Gogh Museum, and I was going to see the potato eaters, and I'm not an expert in art, but I didn't like it at all. It looks almost, the figures look like cartoons, and they look nothing like what came just a couple of years later.
No, it really is stunning. Vincent was so proud of that painting. He spent so many months working on it, and it has a position of prominence in the museum because it's historically so important, because Vincent spent so much time on it.
It was his first major work,
and he wanted Theo to show it in the Salon, which was the big exhibition where all the artists sent their best things every year. It's not a good work, and Theo was quite clear about it. He said, I can't show this around. Nobody's going to want to put it up in their gallery. And the only thing that came close to being a friendship in his life was a relationship with a Dutch artist named Van Rappard. And Van Rappard was so scathing about how badly drawn the figures were, how cartoonish they were, that Vincent and he never spoke again the rest of their lives. So one of the questions is, how does he go from the potato eaters, badly drawn, cartoonish, dark, soapy colors, to these spectacularly well-conceived, well-executed, brightly colored paintings that we all cherish and love so much? It's one of the miracles of art history. And he really sort of, he forced himself. You know, you have a painter like Picasso, who became an abstract artist after he had demonstrated that he could draw like an angel. He could draw like Ingres or like Degas. He could draw a perfect figure or a perfect face almost from the time he was a child, from the time he was five or six. His own father was a painter and said, my God, my child can draw better than I can. And so when he turned to abstraction, it seemed it was just sort of a part of a trajectory in his artistic career. Vincent had to create a new form of art for him to be able to do not only well, but to do acceptably well. If he had had to spend the rest of his life trying to paint normal figures like every other painter in Europe, he would not only have been forgotten, he would never have been considered. And yet, by 1880, even by 1886, but certainly by 1888, he had created a new form of art in which color was, instead of black and white, he wanted the most intense color possible. These paintings are so well known to all of us. You know, the sunflowers, the Starry Nights, and the shoes, and some of the portraits, that they look, they're part of our visual DNA. We see them in posters in dorm rooms. We see them on refrigerator magnets, on cups, on T-shirts, and in magazines and everywhere. It's hard to remember just how shockingly, brilliantly color they were back then. But he also created a way of drawing that, instead of being accurate, was emotionally meaningful. Meaning that when he drew the hands of a sitter in a portrait, they weren't accurate in the way that we think of a painter being accurate. I mean, the fingers don't come out of the hand appropriately. They don't. The knuckles are not where they should be. But they're unbelievably emotionally expressive. And when he made the decision, basically to stop trying to be technically accurate and merely to be expressive, his work goes from being amateurish, worse than amateurish, to being glorious. It's one of the great miracles in art history, and I think it's one of the reasons why the story is so exciting. And also, we think it's one of the reasons why people are drawn so exceptionally to Vincent van Gogh. There's almost a kind of religious mood in museums when he has an exhibition, and in his grave, when people go to 500,000 people a year go to 30 miles north of Paris to visit his grave. That puts us in either Beatles or even Elvis territory. There aren't other artists that people go in by the hundreds of thousands to visit. And I think people, because they know the ear incident, they've seen the self-portraits, they know the story of the supposed suicide, they know he was an unhappy person, even if they don't know the precise, just exactly how unhappy he was. They know the paintings are not only beautiful, but joyful and life-giving. And I think there is an unconscious sense that somehow, and it's accurate, that Vincent extracted these images of consolation and joy and beauty from this terribly, tragically unhappy life. And there's almost a kind of religious meaning to the way he lived his life that I think helps give people a kind of emotional connection to him that we don't have to many or almost any other artists.
Steve, he's got these letters that he sends to Theo saying, I've stayed up all night for four nights in a row. Did painting make him feel better?
It both did and it didn't. Because he was such a perfectionist, because he cared so manically, I mean, these paintings, first of all, he painted almost a painting every day. The productivity is just staggering. And if you look closely at the paintings, there are thousands and thousands of brushstrokes, and every single one of them has to be right. Every single one of them has to, because he painted them in a single day, he was painting wet and wet, which means that the colors would combine on the canvas. He would sometimes have on a brush both a yellow and a blue, and they have to mix perfectly as he places them on the canvas. These are technically, you know, he goes from doing stick figures to doing these unbelievably complex manipulations of paint, and they are a combination of calculation, meaning he used to sit in bed smoking a pipe, which may not have been the safest way to go to bed at night, thinking through the painting he was going to paint the next day, which is really a wonderful thought.
Yeah.
Think of him sitting there in bed.
The
do list for the next day. And on the do list is the sunflowers. And he's imagining how many petals and how many strokes. But then when he was in front of the canvas, calculation had to submit to spontaneity, meaning everything that happened created a whole new set of circumstances that he had to react to. And somebody who watched him painting in the late 1880s said that typically you assume a painter is going to seduce a canvas. Van Gogh, he raped it. And so there was a kind of frenetic quality to it that left him unsettled. But he also he felt very proud of these things. I mean, he certainly didn't know they were going to become world famous. He didn't know that 800,000 people would line up to see them in Seoul, Korea, or in Los Angeles, California. But he was proud of them. He knew he was a very smart guy. That's the other thing that people, I think, will be surprised at is what a thinker he was, what a reader he was, and he knew art history really well, and he had a photographic memory for paintings, so he knew how good these things were, and they made him feel in a way that nothing else could. That he was, that his life meant something, that it added up to something.
One of the things you did was actually go back and go through the literature that captivated him when he was painting.
Well, we did this for. Luckily, we couldn't have done this book if literally dozens and even hundreds of wonderful books hadn't been written about Van Gogh before us. And there was a woman named Fika Pabst at the Van Gogh Museum who did this unbelievable kind of Sherlock Holmes exercise. She went through the letters, and sometimes from even just a few words at a time, without quotation marks around them, she would figure out what some book or poem that Vincent was referring to, and made a list that gave us a kind of roadmap to his literary imagination. And he could read extremely easily in not only Dutch, but also English, French, and German. So he knew Shakespeare. He knew the Bible almost by memory. He had translated the Bible into Dutch, French, English, and German. He knew Dickens. He knew Harriet Beecher Stowe was one of his favorite authors. He read Uncle Tom's Cabin every Christmas. He knew the German Romantic poets. It was important to read all that literature, which is one reason this book took 10 years, not only because when you're trying to get inside somebody's head, you want to experience the world that they experienced, but also Vincent worked thought by association. If he walked into a church and saw an old woman praying, he didn't just see that woman. He saw a print by Rembrandt of a woman praying in a church, or he saw a passage in a novel by one of the French naturalist writers about a woman praying. And his paintings have levels of reference to these works of art and to this literature that make them deeper and more profound. To paraphrase Mark Twain, as beautiful as these paintings are, and they're unbelievably beautiful, they're even better than they look because of all these wonderful associations to literature and to art. And one of the things we hope the book will do is to help people understand just how, I mean, he would spend 5 hours a day reading, and he read furiously, quickly, and he remembered what he read. These paintings are dense with relationships to art and literature that I think will be one of the major surprises for people who haven't read deeply in the Van Gogh in the Van Gogh studies.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Blake in Dallas. Hello, Blake.
Hi, Chris. Hey, I think you guys talked about it a little bit, but the connection between suffering and creativity is pretty well understood in the art world. I'm wondering, with the probable neuropathology that Van Gogh was suffering from, perhaps that altered his perception of light and color. Maybe the seizures were actually changing the way he was perceiving the world.
It's a really good question, and a lot of people have addressed it. There are people who've, in particular, who've wondered whether he saw the color yellow, saw things colored yellow in a way that was beyond reality. Because of the variety of images he created, because of the variety of colors he used, we and the sort of the people who've looked deeply at these paintings don't really think that they were altered in that way by the way he saw neuropathologically, to use the caller's word. The way we think he was affected by his mental illness was what we talked about earlier, his combination of argumentativeness and smothering and all of the other personality traits that came with the mental illness that made him impossible to befriend, meant that he led this alienated life. And one of the reasons why his art took such a specific and different and an individual direction is that he couldn't work with other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Impressionists worked together. There are paintings of the boating party at Argenteuil by Monet and Renoir, which are very similar. They're not
sort of
identical.
There's
a dialogue back and forth. And in fact, Braque and Picasso invented analytical cubism together. And later, there were a couple of paintings which they couldn't remember who had painted which painting. Well, Vincent Van Gogh simply wasn't able to work with other people. He tried a couple of times, famously with Gauguin. It was an utter rout. So one reason that he created a whole new way of painting, which really influenced much of the art that followed, we think came from the alienation, and the alienation came from the mental illness. So we do think there was an effect, but not one that affected specific colors, for example.
Stephen Nafee is my guest. He is co-author, along with Gregory White Smith, of the new book, Van Gogh, The Life. They're in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Nafee, who is co-author with Gregory White Smith of the new book, Van Gogh, The Life. They're in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. Steve, it's almost hard to believe that we've gotten this far into this conversation without discussing this, but as I mentioned in the introduction, one of the shorthand things everybody knows about Van Gogh is that he killed himself when he was 37. You and Greg are not so sure about that.
Yes, certainly the thing that has gotten the most attention. In fact, we were on national television in China for 30 minutes. There have been over 500 articles about the fact that we think there are strong reasons to believe that he didn't kill himself. It turns out now that the book is out and people are writing us, that we are hardly the only people who have suspected this. One of the Van Gogh scholars at the Van Gogh Museum in 2006 told his colleagues that he didn't think Vincent could have killed himself because of the medical evidence of the way that the angle of penetration from the wound and the distance from the body that he was shot from just made it impossible. But since he didn't know all the information, he couldn't imagine who would have killed Vincent Van Gogh. Why would anyone shoot this crazy artist in Auvers? There were people who knew Vincent's life really well who just didn't feel suicide was in his character. I mean, he had been miserable his whole life. He had addressed the issue of suicide in his wonderful letters to Theo, and he'd always called it an act of moral cowardice. And he said over and over and over again, "This is something I would never do. Theo, you too must never do it." You know, it seemed sort of natural on the surface that somebody who would cut off their ear might shoot themselves, but we looked into the literature on self-mutilation, and it's people. One is a call for help. Mm-hmm. The other is a desire to end your life. These are two very different things, and in some ways contradictory. The ear incident was, as you said earlier, in the middle of a psychotic episode, whereas when he killed himself, he wasn't in the middle of a seizure because he sat and talked to Theo as he was dying, and he was completely lucid. But there were other details that just didn't seem right. First of all, no one ever accounted for the gun. I mean, just the sort
of... It was
of
never found, right?
Nobody ever found the gun. And but the similar or related question, who would have given him a gun? Mm-hmm. He'd been in an insane asylum. Half his ear was gone. He looked crazy. He acted crazy. Why would anyone give him a gun? It was supposedly to scare off crows, but it turns out there were no crows in Auvers in July. Mm-hmm. And the last painting that we think, you know, people thought he had made, which was part of the Lust for Life Irving Stone fiction, was the great meditation on death, Crows in the Wheat Field. Well, it turns out that painting was painted about July 10th, more than 2 weeks before he died, and all the paintings between that and his death were very happy paintings. Also, why would he go off in the afternoon to paint and then shoot himself at the end of a painting session? That doesn't make much sense. Why would he shoot himself in the abdomen? Less than 2% of the people who kill themselves with a gunshot wound shoot themselves in a place that usually takes a long time to die. It's very painful. They shoot themselves in the head, which mm-hmm. is the rational thing to do if you want to end your life that way. And if he had shot himself that way or in the abdomen, how could he have come from the wheat fields all the way down to the Auberge Revue where he was living? It was over a mile, and it was down a very steep escarpment. Could he physically have done that? And then little details begin to pop up in the literature. There was, in particular, you start with the medical evidence that the gun was too far out and from this odd angle. Then you read this incredible interview with a boy named René Secretan. Well, it was the end of his life. He was an old man at the time, and he'd become a wealthy banker and businessman and a champion marksman, interestingly. In 1890, he was a 16-year-old rowdy teenager who had bought a Buffalo Bill costume at the Universal Exposition the year before. It was the biggest selling item. Buffalo Bill was the number one attraction at that big fair in Paris. And he was playing cowboy and Indian with a real gun that, as he put it in the interview, went off whenever it felt like. Mm-hmm. And he was shooting rabbits and squirrels and birds. And he and a group of teenagers used to taunt Vincent. This was actually pretty common among boys in villages where Vincent lived. But in Rene's case, they would put salt in his coffee. They put a snake in his paint box so that he blacked out or almost blacked out once. They put chili peppers on the edges of his dried paint brushes because they saw him chewing on them. They brought their girlfriends in from Paris and sort of were intimate with them in front of Vincent to make him uncomfortable. And he gives this weird interview. When people talk about the famous man they once knew, they don't spend the whole 10 pages of an article saying how badly they treated him and come up with the fact that the gun was used in the shooting was their gun.
Yeah.
And then finally, in an obscure place, we read that John Rewald, the great art historian, probably the greatest historian of Impressionism and Post-Impressionism, who was living in France going to school during the 1930s, before World War II, would go to Auvers, north of Paris, and interviewed the villagers. Well, it was only 40 years after Vincent had died, so there were people there who were living and were at least teenagers, if not older, when the shooting occurred. And the rumors he heard in that village was that Vincent had been shot accidentally by a couple of boys, and he decided to take the blame so that their lives wouldn't be ruined. And so you all those facts seem to create a much more plausible scenario for the end of his life than the lust for life fiction.
I mean, when you come up with something like this, and we should say you put it in an appendix to the book,
right,
and not the book itself. I mean, what were the conversations like that you and Greg had about where you put this and how you deal with it? And are you really proposing it as a new theory, or is it just an idea?
Well, we are proposing it as a theory, and we feel pretty strongly, and it's interesting, in the months since the book has come out, most of the experts seem to believe that this is a more plausible theory than the original one. We definitely talked about it a lot because we knew that it's one of the more famous suicides among creative people in world history, that it would get some attention. We didn't think 500 articles in 3 days, lots of television coverage, 6 times on the BBC in one day.
Many authors would envy that, we should say.
But we also knew that that academics would have a problem with it. They don't like that kind of detail being explored. And we also knew that it would overshadow the book a bit. And as it did for about a week, finally we're having some wonderful conversations like the one that you've had with me today, where we talk about all the, you know, this huge life, this incredible opportunity to get inside this unique imagination. But we knew that it would overshadow this 10-year effort. And then we felt, well, who else is going to do this? Somebody needs to do it someday. Somebody needs to present this alternate evidence. And a curator at a museum or an academic, these are pretty conservative places. This is not the kind of thing they do. So if we didn't get it out into the dialogue, we knew there was a chance it never would. And we think it's actually, in some ways, even though it's not as satisfying a myth, satisfying a part of the myth, as him going out in the wheat fields and shooting himself, there's something so noble and or generous, let's say, about taking the blame because otherwise these kids' lives would be destroyed, says something so positive about him that we think it's an important part of the story to get out. We put it in the appendix, and it informs the description of the death. But because we can't be absolutely sure, in fact, we showed it to a lot of lawyers. This is really not art history. This is really forensics. And we showed the evidence to a lot of lawyers, and they said, every one of them said, you could never convict Vincent van Gogh of attempted suicide based on this evidence. It's clear enough that the story of the suicide has so many holes in it. Attempted suicide, which was a crime in 1890, you would never have been able to convict Vincent van Gogh of attempted suicide. By the same token, you know, the evidence is certainly not clear enough to convict René Secretan of attempted murder either. And we don't think there was any intentionality. We don't think he really intended to kill Vincent van Gogh, but we think that it's a far more plausible account of the end than the one that has been in the literature until now.
Steve, as you mentioned earlier, images of Van Gogh paintings are everywhere. You can, you know, they're on T-shirts and tote bags and umbrellas, and we've all been sort of raised to know these are beautiful things. But it does seem that objectively they are beautiful, and people find them pleasing. Why could he not make a decent living selling paintings when he was alive?
Well, we talked about this a little bit before. They are so beautiful to us because 100 years have passed, and what was shocking in 1890 is no longer shocking at all.
It's now part of the canon.
Part of the canon. I mean, we look at abstract images. You look at Mark Rothko with bright reds and bright greens and bright yellows and blues all the time. So these things that Vincent helped make, not only acceptable, but these images look inevitable to us. Well, they sure didn't in 1890. In 1890, people were just finally coming to terms with Impressionism. Impressionism, with its very soft colors and its very gentle scenes of water lilies and haystacks and these sort of pleasant subjects with these wonderfully pleasant colors were they were finally taking over from the salon images of very, very sharply drawn, very realistic mm-hmm. images of mythological scenes or historical scenes or portraits. The world wasn't ready for Vincent van Gogh, but this is what's actually interesting. And our first book was on Jackson Pollock, and he too had no technical facility of the traditional kind. He too had to invent a whole new way of painting for his unbelievable capacity to create images to be realized. He came at just the right time in history. The art world had shifted from Paris to America, to New York. A lot of the artists had come from Paris to escape the war. And culturally and economically, economically and politically and militarily, America was becoming the world leader. And there was an expectation that culture should follow, that America would now be the leader of culture. And we wanted there to be a great American artist. And Clement Greenberg, the critic in New York, picked Jackson out because he was one of the few painters in America who'd actually been born in America yeah. and was actually from Cody, Wyoming. Well, Vincent van Gogh, the same thing. The world was looking for the art world was in transition. Not the buyers, but the artists were increasingly dissatisfied with the world as they knew it, meaning the war of 1870, the Franco-Prussian War, had been such a disaster. So many people were killed so needlessly. There was no reason for that war. Science was changing the way we perceived the world, and people didn't really feel comfortable with what was the world going to be when science finally revealed life as we know it. Religion was waning, so people didn't the comfortable existence and the sort of reassurance of faith was waning, and artists began to think the world that we look at isn't the really important world. The only world that mattered in this shifting uncertainty was what we experience inside. Mm-hmm. And so the art world was looking for a more inner directed kind of art. The symbolists as a group sort of began to meet that need. But down in southern France, in this insane asylum, this crazy artist was doing the most inner-directed work of art, and a young art critic named Albert Aurier, in the initial issue of an art magazine called Mercure de France, does what Clement Greenberg did with Jackson Pollock. He says, the greatest living artist is this person you may not have heard of named Vincent van Gogh who's painting these convulsive, unbelievably volcanic, you can imagine the adjectives that he used. And that's how they looked to people in 1890. So basically, as with Pollock, the art world comes to Vincent, meaning he's painting what he has to paint. He can paint no other way. Meanwhile, what he's doing becomes exactly what the art world is looking for, and he actually becomes famous not after he dies, but just before he dies. He sells one painting for the equivalent of $1,200. He shows some paintings at an exhibition in Brussels, and an artist as important as Claude Monet mm-hmm. say, this guy's doing some really interesting things. So just at the very end of his life, people began to realize that that Van Gogh was doing something important, and his ascent after his death was meteoric. I mean, he becomes very, very well known within 10 or 20 years, and then all of a sudden Irving Stone writes Lust for Life in the 30s, and then he's hugely well known. Then Kirk Douglas, who very sweetly asked for a copy of the book, really touched, turns him into this great movie in the 50s, and everybody in the world knows him.
Stephen Naifeh is with Gregory White Smith of the new book Van Gogh, The Life. They will be speaking tonight at the Dallas Museum of Arts, Arts and Letters Live. Steve, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris, so much. This has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.